It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Two big stories this week. Jeff, Gina, Kevin Marks will join us to talk about the passing of Aaron Schwartz and his legacy, mighty that it is. We'll also talk about the new Google social graph search. Might even explain what that means. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 181, recorded January 16th, 2013. I bonked my little thingy. This Week in Google is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com, click on the microphone, and enter Twig. And by LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom's not a law firm. LegalZoom provides self-help services at your direction, such as affordable business and personal documents you can trust. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TWIG to get $10 off at checkout. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. The show, and I got to caution you, because this show is not going to be much about Google. The show that covers the cloud, the internet, media, society, larger issues, as well as just, you know, what's new with Google. Let's introduce the panel for today. As always, the wonderful Gina Trapani from smarterware.org and ThinkUp. Great to have you, Gina. She's in Brooklyn.
Great to be here. I'm in Manhattan at the moment. I'm generously being hosted by 20 by 200, which is subleasing a space in the Foursquare office.
Oh, so cool. That's a nice office. I've seen that. Yeah, beautiful office. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really nice. And there's something very satisfying about being able to check in at Foursquare on Foursquare.
It's just magic.
Yeah, it's just it's very meta.
Jeff Jarvis is also off-site. Jeff Jarvis from BuzzMachine.com. Hi, Jeff. You're in Rhode Island.
Hi there. I'm in Rhode Island at Bryant University. I gave a talk to the Helen Library Consortium today, following David Weinberger, very hard. And the great thing is, you know, you go anywhere in this country, in this world, I go downstairs, two people come up to me. They're Twit fans. They're Twig fans. Dave Gannon here at Bryant happens to be, he teaches technology, and he also did tech support. And so he answered my questions about the network. This is the wonder of Leo Laporte and Twit. Your network is everywhere.
Yay! Well, I grew up down the road from them, so I know the area pretty well. That's great. Good to have you. And thanks to the folks at Bryant University for letting you use their facilities. And from his garden, where he always appears, like a garden gnome, Kevin Marks.
Hi there.
TunnelVision.tv and Salesforce.com. Hello, Kevin. Kevin asked to be on today because he knew we would be talking. And there really only a couple of big stories today. One, of course, the Aaron Schwartz story, but the other, the Facebook social graph story. And in both of these, I think Kevin Marks will certainly have a lot to say.
I'll try and join in, yes.
Yeah. They're kind of right in your wheelhouse, as we Americans are wont to say. But before we do that, I think it'd be a good time to play the trumpets and announce the change log.
Google change log.
Google change log time. For those of you into the Google, by the way, I might mention Google has a good search front page today.
The Google Doodle is exciting today.
Yeah. Should we just show this before we get into the change log?
Yeah.
It's got a little Zamboni machine. And if you press play, you get to play the Zamboni game or something. What am I doing?
It tells you.
I love games where there's no text. Okay, got it. Yes.
It's the IKEA of games.
Yeah. Oh, you're supposed to clean up the mess with a Zamboni. See? Those damn skaters, they make a heck of a mess.
Get off my ice.
Get off of my ice. What is this to commemorate, Gina?
Mr. Zamboni would be very old if you were alive today at his birthday.
What is this? I'm looking for the mouse over. What is this to commemorate? I'm honestly not sure, but I think I can Zamboni's have a career birthday in Zamboni running.
It is Zamboni's birthday?
I think so, yeah.
It's even got Zamboni. An 8-bit sound.
Oh, yeah.
Da 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 dum. I beat you. Okay, Chad's going to play now. Good luck, Chad.
Sorry, I'm not getting your audio from your...
I know. So you have to do yours.
Frank Zamboni, I'm sure it's Francis Xavier, but Frank Zamboni would be 112 years old today.
Holy cow.
Which makes me amazed, yes. Ah.
Zamboni machine, for those who don't know, is used on skating rinks. I remember going to ice hockey games at Brown University, just down the road from you there, Jeff Jarvis. And it's an amazing contraption that involves levers, steam. It comes out. It runs over the ice and makes it fresh and new again, melting and refreezing it.
The problem with the game ones that you can't... Normally, you can click on the doodle and get search results for the thing that it represents.
Right.
But with this, you click on it and just the game starts and it's hard to tell.
We don't know.
Yeah, I always kind of like that the Google's kind of, the doodle's sort of educational. You're like, oh, today is this crazy holiday I've never heard of. But with this one, it's hard to tell what it is. And you're just like, oh, it's a Zamboni. Exciting.
You got a certain amount of gas. That's kind of, I don't know. It's just crazy. I think they've realized these are a big selling point. And the only reason the Zamboni is popular is because it's got a great name.
Yeah.
Because it is kind of a contraption.
It's a cool machine.
Yeah.
But when I went to the U.S. Open and it rains, they've got the hot weather version of it, which goes and vacuums up all the water.
Frank Zamboni and the ice resurfacing machine. It's every Minnesota kid's hero. He's an Italian American from Minnesota, I guess.
Yeah, he's paisan.
Yeah.
He's a paisan.
That's cool. What else is new at Google?
We got a couple of new things this week. Google added high-res photo zoom to Google Plus. I mean, more and more, it feels like Google Plus is really becoming a photo-sharing network. So if you go to a Google Plus post that has a high-res image in it, you click on the high-res image, you get the regular kind of light box. But then you can use your mouse wheel to scroll in. You can zoom and pan on an image. So I think I dropped a link to an example post there that has a high-res image in the doc. And, yeah, click on one of those images, and you'll see.
You can zoom in. Wow. So are these like gigapan style images or?
Yeah, so on my Mac, I have to sort of do the two finger scroll on my trackpad to get it to work. Let's see. It's where you can click.
Should I do it, yes. Chad?
Yeah.
All right.
Sorry.
I was watching a video about the Zamboni machine.
Sorry, I should have prepped you for this demo.
Wait. Oh, I just got it. I just got it.
There it goes.
Here we are. So. What's weird is on my Mac,
Ooh. It
looks like I'm scrolling to the left and to the right, which is problematic because that's how you go forward and backwards. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's,
so
that's
you can
pretty
pan,
neat.
Pan and zoom. So that box shows up in the top left, and you can really see detail on high resolution images.
That is nice.
Yeah,
is there a
is there
a checkbox you have to do, or did it just automatically see
it? Just did it.
It's just the trackpad. You have to kind of drag and zoom on your trackpad.
Come over
here.
Yeah,
I'm trying to see if you have a mouse.
Oh, there we go.
Ooh.
There's the thingy.
Yeah. The thingy. I had trouble, like, initiating the thingy at first, but once you start to do it.
You can't stop it.
I love it when you talk technical, Gina.
Yeah, I know. I know. I'm getting very technical. These are the technical
two fingers on a Mac trackpad works great.
Right, right. Or you could use your mouse scroll wheel.
That's probably what you're supposed to do, yeah.
Yeah, that's probably what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Yep. So what else? Oh, Chrome beta for Android has been released. This is actually difficult to find in the Play Store. If you search Chrome in the Play Store, it won't show up. But if you search for Chrome beta for Android in Google itself, you'll get the Play Store link. It's just it's a few versions ahead. It's basically the equivalent of subscribing to the beta channel in Chrome on your desktop, which I do anyway. It's a little unstable, a few more bug fixes. You kind of get to test the new stuff before it comes out in the stable release.
Does
sooner.
It auto update?
It does auto update. It does auto update.
So we'll always be a few versions ahead.
Yep. And I've actually switched to the Chrome beta as my default browser on my Galaxy Nexus, and I haven't had any problems. I had one problem with ThinkUp, which is the site that I build. Now I have heard reports and all about Android community that it is crashing some devices. But the nice thing is you can have both the stable Chrome and the beta installed on your phone and switch between them. It's got the beta has this little kind of sash that says beta across the icon, so you can test it out if you want. And also on the desktop, there's a new stable release of Chrome. Not too many big new features, just mostly stability and performance improvements. And the Chrome 25 beta is also now available, and it's in the Web-to-Speech API, which is the thing that lets you talk to your browser and give it voice commands. Yeah. That's now available. So that's kind of exciting.
On Android, cool to see too, or just on the desktop?
No, this is on the desktop. This is Chrome 25 beta on the desktop.
Okay.
My other favorite Android app, although I have lots of favorite Android apps, but Google Now gets boarding passes. So this is really cool. If you've booked a flight and in your Gmail you have the confirmation number on a flight and then you arrive at an airport, and I'm actually really excited to try this because I've got a JetBlue flight back to San Diego. And when I show up at JFK, in theory, if it's all working, Google Now is going to pop up a card that says, hey, here's your boarding pass, and gives me my barcode to scan at the gate. What's a little weird about this is that Google has announced that this feature is shipping, but they said that it works with select airlines, but they haven't said what airlines it works with. So it's kind of a crapshoot at this point. But I'm excited about that. And in fact, I think we talked about this a few shows ago. If you have if you've booked flights and the confirmation is in your Gmail, if you search on Google.com for the phrase "my flights," the one box comes up and says, hey, your flight's on time. Here's when it leaves. Here's when it arrives. That totally works for me now. Like, my upcoming flight is showing up there. So this is just the Google Now card is sort of an extension of that. And finally, in Gmail, signature tweaks, which was a Labs feature that let you put your signature above the quoted text and erase the two dashes that show up by default. That used to be Gmail Labs. It's graduated. It's now in just general settings, right? So it lets you customize your signature a little bit more. So if you go to in your Gmail account, if you go to settings, general, you'll see the ability to put your signature up above the quoted text and without those two dashes. So signature tweaks graduates. Congratulations from Labs. And that's all I got.
And that's the Google change log. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
So let's start with Aaron Swartz, because it's not quite old news, but it's almost old news now. As many know, Aaron, 26 years old, a young man who really had made a huge difference and was unique in a number of respects, one of which he was apparently a technology genius who, instead of trying to make $1 billion inventing the next YouTube, devoted his time to the public wheel and, in fact, did quite a bit of good. Kevin, I gather he passed away on Friday, killed himself on Friday. Kevin, I gather you knew him fairly well.
I first met him back in 2002 when he was 15 or so.
Wow.
And he was working on web standards, and I think he was one of the first people who sort of appeared out of the net and said hi, because we were chatting online in various web standards groups, RSS and some of the web staff, and he mentioned he was visiting California and could he come and visit me, and I was at Apple at the time, said sure, come for lunch, and I was surprised when this young kid turned up. He was always fairly small when he was younger. He got a bit bigger later on, but he was like, oh, but it was, but he was always very, very sharp and brilliant. It was one of those experiences of that we had in the early days of blogging, where we felt like we were a small community anyway. And we were all, talking about the web and standards, and Aaron was making significant contributions to that. And he was, he'd moved to being homeschooled or unschooled, rather than going to high school. And so was therefore working on stuff at home, which meant the net was his connection to the rest of the world. And he took advantage of that. He wrote a very good, piece, well, several good pieces, one on how to get the job I have, where he talked about his history of that. And, where he said that the main thing is curiosity, and he spent all his time reading everything he could, and what he felt that not going to high school meant that he didn't have the curiosity knocked out of him being forced to read things he didn't want to.
Yes.
And so he was able to focus on the things that's inspired him and keep working on them. And he did lots of really, really useful stuff.
One of his early credits was working on RSS. What did he do for the spec?
Here's a picture,
by the way. While you're talking, I'm showing a picture of him talking to Larry Lessig, and this is roughly around 14 years old.
That was about the time when
And the amazing thing is, here you see a Stanford law professor not merely patronizing or indulging a kid, but really talking to him. And in fact, these conversations led to Creative Commons, which Aaron wrote the first iteration of. A 14-year-old for a an acknowledged constitutional scholar, one of the foremost constitutional scholars in the United States. So he obviously must have had some obvious brilliance at that age.
He was a genius.
Yeah.
He was a genius.
Yeah. You knew him too, Gina. Did you?
I did. I met him a couple of times at Foo Camp.
I think I played werewolf with him, and now I've forgotten.
Yeah. I mean, I followed his work for so long that when I met him at Foo Camp, I was actually at a table sitting next to him, and I was too starstruck to to start a conversation. Like, I kind of stared at him a little bit, and that was it. And now I really regret it. But
no kidding.
Yeah, so, he would have never said that he's a genius. He had a humility about it. He said, oh, well, you know, it's really just curiosity. But the reality is he was a genius.
So tell us about the RSS contribution.
Well, he worked, I don't want to get into the history of RSS too much, but he was very much involved with the RDF worldview, which was Tim Berners-Lee model of the web, or the future of the web, which is all about connecting things with links. Everything's a sort of three-part verb. Three-part sentence, and the middle, so you've got a subject, a predicate, and another, and an object, and each of those things are URLs, and it's just a very abstract way of specifying the web, and it's one of those things that in some ways is over-abstracted. I think, you know, we've sort of realized that it's actually quite hard to express stuff in that form and keep it consistent, and things have changed, but it was around 2000, it was very exciting, and Aaron leaped on this, and help build the iteration of RSS that was based on RDF, which was RSS 1.0. And then there was a whole bunch of back and forth and with Dave Weiner and others, and there was a non-RDF version of RSS. RSS 2 became the mainline one. And then Aaron, as a prank almost, invented RSS 3, which was one without any XML in it at all and was just plain text. And so playing jokes like that, he actually wrote a very coherent spec that was actually useful and parsable. You know, if you look up RSS 3, you read it and you go, oh, yeah, that's almost JSON, really. But it was him just sort of playing with the idea of, oh, you think RDF's too complicated? Well, XML's too complicated. Here's this thing.
Right.
So he was like a lot of brilliant people, he was always sort of dancing around, how do I explain this to you? But he wasn't nasty about it. I mean, he could probe at you and sort of show you up by being smart, but he didn't tend to be nasty about it.
Here's a great picture of Aaron with Doug Engelbart on the right, the man who invented the computer mouse, and on the left, Ted Nelson, who was one of the early proponents of hypertext.
Wow, what a kid.
Isn't it amazing? Just an amazing picture. Yeah.
But, you know, and sometimes I'm not sure we want to focus on, you know, everyone said he did all these amazing things when he was 15, and it's true, but he carried on doing amazing things.
Oh, he did.
He went to Stanford for a year and then dropped out because he decided he wasn't learning enough, he wasn't intellectual enough. And then he went in the very first Y Combinator class because Paul Graham rang about and said, I'm doing this thing, I think you'd enjoy it. And he built Infogami there, which was a sort of publicly editable web thing, but then worked with the guys who'd founded Reddit and basically helped them port it from Lisp to Python so it would actually scale on the web, and then worked with them for the first two years or so of Reddit until they got bought out by
Condé Nast.
Yes, and that moved him to move them all to San Francisco and put them in the Wired offices, and he didn't like that very much, and eventually sort of flaked out of that and moved away again.
Kevin Poulsen tells a story of when Aaron arrived at the Wired offices, newly rich from the acquisition of Reddit, and said, "I would like to, if you wouldn't mind, to write an article about an ongoing trial about a fairly abstruse topic in intellectual property law." And Kevin says he wrote a brilliant article. You know, he was a great writer. He's obviously an amazingly talented person.
Well, that was the thing. He was always interested in the politics and sociology of the web as well. And he'd, you know, part of that was working with Lessig and co at Creative Commons to construct that. He also got very into reading Noam Chomsky and the theory of the sociology of power and all that stuff. And so after he'd done Reddit, he founded a lot of political action groups. He was extremely...
Demand Progress was one, of course, that...
Demand Progress was the one that he originally built to stop COICA, which is the predecessor to SOPA, but became a general activism tool.
And absolutely instrumental in stopping SOPA and PIPA.
There's a really good speech of him at if you search for Aaron Schwartz SOPA on YouTube, you'll find it, which is him speaking to Freedom to Connect, I think. It's about 20 minutes long, which I recommend everyone to watch because it's him summarizing the what happened with the history of the SOPA revolt, and it's just a wonderful piece of speech making. And it will give you a feel for, you know, the because, you know, we've seen all these photos of him as 14 years old, and it gives you, this was last autumn, and it gives you a feel for the guy he grew up into and the stuff he was trying to do. And then, you know, and he spent a lot of time working on how do we create open public resources. So he built he wrote the specs for and built the first iteration of the open library thing that they have at the Internet Archive, which is an index of all the books that exist and designed to, you know, derive from existing ISBN databases and things like that, so that there's a effectively a universal card index for books that isn't just Amazon numbers, and that's been hooked up now to the scans that the Internet Archive is doing, so that they're trying to collate all books that have been published too, in a way that is actually a public resource in parallel with the stuff that Amazon and Google have done with which have been the publishers.
He obviously embraced one of the fundamental hacker tenets that information wants to be free. He said information is power, but like all power, there are those who want to keep it to themselves. And he really worked very actively to get these silos of information that should be public released.
And Leo, I think that's the key to the, you know, I unfortunately don't think I met him. I may have been at the same conference at some point, quite possibly, but I learned a lot from him. And in what he did with JSTOR, and of course that's what led to all of his legal troubles, was that he downloaded millions of articles from an MIT closet.
Well,
it
wasn't the
machine.
First time he'd done it. In fact, it's important to note that he first got in trouble with the FBI for something that wasn't a crime. There's a database of court precedents, of court decisions called
the government was charging for. The government was charging a dollar or is
even
a dollar
though
page,
it is absolutely public domain material. It's court decisions. He used, I'd said, much of the money that he made from Reddit to buy Pacer documents and put them into an open database called Recap, which is not illegal. But
all the FBI still, you know, harassed him and went after him.
It's said that really was the beginning of this antipathy between him and the feds.
So then he downloaded the stuff from JSTOR, which is academic articles, and you know, I won't recount that whole thing, but that led to a harassment of prosecution, the fear of a huge amount of time in jail, the loss of all the money he had, all this uncertainty, and I think he's being portrayed sometimes as if that was a protest or an act of civil disobedience. But I think it was an example. I think it was a lesson. And what he taught me, just to your point that you just made, Leo, is that it's not that information wants to be free. Is kind of a lesson that I learned from him in this. It's the way I put it in a post this week is the question is, does knowledge want to be content? So, you know, the content wants to be free is the argument people like me get accused of saying, well, you just want to make it all free. Well, no, but I do want knowledge to be free. I want knowledge to be freed up. And I gave this talk here today at this library conference, and I put up a picture of Free Willy, and, you know, he freed the whale. Well, what Aaron was really doing was freeing the whale of knowledge from the tank of JSTOR. And we're stuck in our old models of thinking that you can own content and thus own the knowledge that comes into it. And that's what he was about. When information wants to be free, when knowledge wants to be freed up, but that's what we should all be about. And that's what he was really about. And it really changed a lot of my view about the basic architecture of media, and that was from his actions.
So, you know, his own family released a statement basically blaming federal prosecutors and MIT for his death. Now, they acknowledged that he'd had, and I don't have any knowledge of this, but that he'd had a long time battle with depression anyway.
He'd written about it. He blogged about that.
Yeah, openly talked about it. But they were very clear that they believed that. Now, what happened was JSTOR, which is the commercial entity that he downloaded this stuff from, he did it, by the way, and everybody I've seen talk about this, including Kevin Polson and others, say this was not a hack in any sense of the word. He used so he was at Harvard at the time. He went to MIT, where JSTOR is openly available to anybody on the MIT network for free, and started downloading vast quantities of material and began a cat and mouse game with MIT authorities who were trying to stop it. Eventually put a laptop in a closet and downloaded, I think it was 4.8 million documents from JSTOR. This is that repository of academic papers. And this is what he got in trouble for, wire fraud and theft. And the implication being that he somehow wanted to benefit financially from it. It's pretty clear that was never the intent. He did, when first confronted, apparently run from the police, but eventually turned himself in.
Gave the disk drives to JSTOR.
Yep.
JSTOR dropped their complaint.
Well, that's MIT. The interesting thing. JSTOR dropped their complaint, but MIT did not. Now, MIT has launched an investigation into how they behaved, obviously embarrassed by what happened.
I thought eventually they had.
No.
No.
Eventually, it was a mixed message,
according to what I've read, that maybe they did, but it was sufficient for federal prosecutors to continue their prosecution. Had both parties said, no, we don't want to press charges, I don't know if the feds would have gone ahead.
It would have been harder for them, but the problem is they'd already got the investigation going. And there's some, you know, the Secret Service was involved. There was a bunch of other stuff going on. And there's some discussion that it may have been connected to some of the other hacking incidents in the Cambridge hacking community. So, WikiLeaks and connections with Occupy and those things, and trying to use him as pressure on others and that kind of thing. It's not clear. And the problem is that it was very hard for anyone to talk about this, because if you do talk about it, you then get subpoenaed to testify against him. And so I you know, when he was first arraigned, I talked to some of people, more his closer friends, and they said, yes, I'm being called before the jury, and I don't want to talk to you about it, so you don't get dragged in too. So there was this prosecutorial intimidation thing going on that made it very hard for people to discuss it, and it was very hard for him to sort of talk about it in public and try and get people to raise money for his defense, because that was also seen as sub judice in effect. So there was an enormous amount of pressure on him from that angle as well.
This is sometimes called a terms of service prosecution. He was violating terms of service, and it being charged with a charge that eventually could have cost him 35 years in jail and several million dollars in fines. The story went that the feds offered him a plea bargain down to he'd have to plead guilty and 6 months in jail, which he turned down because, I think rightly so, he felt that no jail time was appropriate.
Also, he'd have to plead guilty to 13 felonies.
He'd be a felon for the rest of his life.
And God knows what else they would require about his connection to the internet. Look what the feds have done in other cases, Mitnick and Company, where they keep you off the internet, which would have been death to him. But he was also a depressed young man who, by the way, could basically only eat white rice. The idea of even 6 months in prison for any of us would be earth-shattering.
I just honor Zoe Lofgren, who is a member of Congress from Silicon Valley, who went on Reddit, and I think it's a really appropriate place for her to announce this, and said, I'm Representative Zoe Lofgren, and I'm introducing Aaron's Law to change the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to eliminate these terms of service crimes.
Because part of the problem here, too, is this is a case where we're treating technology differently. And we're making the same crime that would be perpetrated in other ways, Xeroxing or other ways. It's much worse because it's computers, and computers are scary, and computers are dangerous.
Yes.
And we're still in that mode where we thus demonize the potential use of technology for all of us. And this kind of prosecution affects all of us. And so we've got to ramp that down, that idea that technology is different.
Her bill would eliminate criminal fines and punishment for this kind of exceeds authorized access crime, which is the crimes he was charged with, and is currently you can go to jail for a very long time for exceeding authorized access.
Well, this is the CFFA was CFAA, sorry, was written a long time ago. It was written when computers were huge, expensive boxes that required people to maintain them and attend them. They were very hard to connect together, and they were, you know, they were fortified in effect. And now we carry three of them around in our pockets every day, and this law has not been amended since. And that is so. There's all these. If you actually look at the things he was accused of, they are these sort of bizarre technicalities like exceeding authorized access and you know, things that all of us do 25 times a day. And there are, you know, there are two other people who are currently in cases like that. There's I can't remember his real name. Rabite is his R-A-B-I-T-E is his Twitter handle. Has been prosecuted because he exposed AT&T's insecure records of people with iPhones, which he did by incrementing the ID number for each user, as you do when you do with a database.
Wasn't so hard, was it?
So he has been prosecuted for adding one to a
that's
number.
Andrew Arnheimer.
Andrew Arnheimer, that's it. And there's, you know, there are other cases like this. And in fact, this is, you know, we know about this one primarily because Aaron committed suicide, and we can now talk about it. But this same technique is used all the time in computer cases to intimidate. And you know, sometimes they're doing this because there is actual fraud going on and theft. And the Boston Prosecutor's Office has caught some people who were hacking into credit card machines and things like that, point of sale systems. And so they're used to that worldview. They're used to, like, we have these criminals and we have to treat them as criminals, and used to expanding the law that way. And in some ways, I think, you know, Aaron was like the, you know, in Bonfire of the Vanities, they have the great white defendant. They finally caught someone who isn't poor, and they want to show that the law is even, so they want to prosecute him too. I think there was some of that going on, as well as this. I think there's a piece, there's a little bit in the, I'll see if I can find the clip for you, in Aaron's speech to Freedom to Connect, where he talks about talking to a congressman and the anger that he has. I'll find that clip and dig it out for you and put it in the chat. Hang on.
Oh, no, it's all. We're all in agreement. Keep it's talking. A great tragedy for him and his family and partner, but also a great loss for our community. And the behavior of MIT, probably, and certainly of the federal prosecutors, is shameful.
You know, looking back at his work, at his blog, and at his talks, you know, he talked about depression. He talked about depression. He gave a lot of talks. He also, in 2002, posted his will. I mean, he believed very strongly that you should live in public and you should share information. In fact, part of his will, I mean, you know, it's kind of a jokey page. It's like, hey, if I get hit by a bus, like, this is what I need you to do. And he actually asked that he name someone as his, you know, person to execute his wishes. And one of his wishes is that all his entire hard drive is published online after his death. Like, he was a very strong believer in sharing information and living in public. And even just reading back through his blog post from when he was, you know, a young kid going through sort of awkward phases of growing up and crushes and all sorts of things, and his sort of musings on what it's like to walk into a room and have everyone stare at you because you're 15, you know, being judged from your looks versus being online. It's fascinating. And, you know, as far as I know, he didn't leave a note, but he left lots of notes. You know, he left this trail of work behind him. And you know, and I think that the fact that this happened on the anniversary of his arrest,
that says
it says a lot. As much of a note as you need.
Yeah. It's just, it's so tragic, so hard. And you
terrible.
Know, what's interesting is how much it rocked the internet community. A lot of people who didn't know him were just as affected by those who did. I mean, it was really a shocker. And so sad. There are a number of tributes to him in the Internet Archives. They're putting together an archive of Aaron S.W. memorabilia. There's a tribute to him on Twitter, hashtag PDF tribute, where academics are publishing illegally their academic articles.
They have the copyright.
Well, if they have the copyright, I don't think they always have the copyright. I think often the institution.
They are sometimes
the
forced to assign it to the journals. Yes, which is.
Right. I've liberated a few JSTOR documents in Aaron's name this week. There's a bookmarklet in order to do that.
Yeah, the Internet Archive did that. That's definitely a troll of the week.
So there are lots of ways to honor him.
A link to the clip in the chat room.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure where the best place to put it actually. Is that good? Can you see that?
Yep.
Look at that clip and him talking to a senator about the law, because this marks the attitude that he was met with.
Chad, I don't know if you have my audio yet or not. Let me play it and see if you do. And if you don't, then you can play it. Chad Johnson has control of the helm at the con here.
Talking, and I got introduced to a U.S. senator, one of the strongest proponents of the original COICA bill, in fact. And I asked him why, despite being such a progressive, despite giving a speech in favor of civil liberties, why he was supporting a bill that would censor the Internet. And, you know, that typical politician smile he had suddenly faded from his face, and his eyes started burning this fiery red. And he started shouting at me. He said, "Those people on the Internet, they think they can get away with anything. They think they can just put anything up there, and there's nothing we can do to stop them. They put up everything. They put up our nuclear missiles, and they just laugh at us. Well, we're going to show them. There's got to be laws on the Internet. It's got to be under control." Now, as far as I know, nobody has ever put up the U.S.'s nuclear missiles on the Internet. I mean, it's just not something I've heard about. But that's sort of the point. He wasn't having a rational concern, right? It was this irrational fear that things were out of control. Here was this man, a United States senator. And those people on the Internet, they were just mocking him. They had to be brought under control. Things had to be under control. And I think that was the attitude of Congress. And just to seeing that fire in that senator's eyes scared me. I think those hearings scared a lot of people. They saw this wasn't the attitude of a thoughtful government trying to resolve trade-offs in order to best represent its citizens. This was more like the attitude of a tyrant. And so the citizens fought back. The wheels came off the bus pretty quickly after that hearing. First, the Republican senators pulled out. And then the White House issued a statement opposing the bill. And then the Democrats, left all alone out there, announced they were putting the bill on hold so they could have a few further discussions before the official vote. And that was when, as hard as it was for me to believe, after all this, we had won. The thing that everyone said was impossible, that some of the biggest companies in the world had written off as kind of a pipe dream, had happened. We did it. We won. And then we started rubbing it in. You all know what happened next. Wikipedia went black. Reddit went black. Craigslist went black. The phone lines on Capitol Hill flat out melted. Members of Congress started rushing to issue statements retracting their support for the bill that they were promoting just a couple days ago. It was just ridiculous. I mean, there's a chart from the time that captures it pretty well. It says something like January 14th on one side, and has this big, long list of names supporting the bill, and then just a few lonely people opposing it. And then on the other side, it says January 15th, and now it's totally reversed. Everyone is opposing it. Just a few lonely names still hanging on in support. I mean, this really was unprecedented. Don't take my word for it, but ask former Senator Chris Dodd, now the chief lobbyist for Hollywood. He admitted, after he lost, that he had masterminded the whole evil plan. And he told the New York Times he'd never seen anything like it during his many years in Congress. And everyone I've spoken to agrees. The people rose up and they caused a sea change in Washington. Not the press, which refused to cover the story. Just coincidentally, their parent companies all happened to be lobbying for the bill. Not the politicians, who were pretty much unanimously in favor of it. And not the companies who had all but given up trying to stop it and decided it was inevitable. It was really stopped by the people themselves.
Aaron Schwartz talking about the reaction to SOPA. There's more to it if you want to watch it on YouTube, just how we stopped SOPA. I didn't realize that that's almost exactly a year ago. It was a year ago, a couple of days ago.
I think it's this Friday.
Wow.
That there's an event in San Francisco to get together about it.
Now maybe all those sites will go black for Aaron. That might not be a bad way to remember him. Terrible loss. Very sad story.
Yes.
And I don't know if there's a moral to be drawn from it, except just, we should just reinvigorate it in our work to continue his work.
And it, no, I think you're absolutely right, Leo. And there's another angle here too, which is, and there was a story I just saw online. I didn't put on the rundown yet, but also in the technology industry, we have to deal with depression and depression among geniuses. And I'm not saying the depression is what made us lose Aaron. He was also hounded, but it was part of it. And what Cory Doctorow wrote was absolutely beautiful. And also the fact that people like Cory and Dana talked about their own demons they've dealt with, and this brought that out. It's we've got to let people know they're not alone. We've got to talk to them. It's far more widespread than we know. And that's an issue we have to deal with as well. And I think that in our industry that is peopled by many, many geniuses who have some difficulties with an insane world, I think we have to show support and be aware of that.
Danny O'Brien is one of Aaron's friends. Went on this. He was on the airplane actually back from Aaron's funeral, and he just had this just amazing spree on Twitter. It was very funny. He's Mala, M-A-L-A on Twitter, but he kind of ended this long rant saying that we all need to continue Aaron's work and that we have to look at all his public writings and all the things that he taught us and carry on his good work. But there was this one tweet where he said, everyone needs to make copies of everything. Civilization does not back up itself.
I love that.
And I was like, that is that is rant. Spot on.
yeah, I really love that.
Right. Now, I think I've just put the link to Danny's tweets in the chat as well. The other thing about depression and why it's particularly hard for people who are very logical is that a lot of what depression does is takes away your feeling that you can overcome things. Your feeling that you are special and the world is not to destroy. In some ways, it makes you hyper-rational and takes away the piece of you that says, oh, that can't be that bad. It's like, in the Hitchhiker's Guide, there's Douglas Adams has this thing called the total perspective vortex. Yeah. And you go into it and it shows you how insignificant you are compared to the rest of the universe. And people go mad and die from it. He did it as a comedy thing so that
Save Five People Brox did not get him. Right.
But that's effectively what depression does to you. It makes you think, I'm insignificant, I don't matter, the world will be better off without me. And I also think that, Aaron being as brilliant as he was put in this situation where he didn't have a way out.
Yeah.
Was said, you're either going to go to trial and potentially go to jail for 30 years, or you're going to go to jail for 6 months. And he knew that either way that would break him. He couldn't manage, working in an office, let alone going to jail. Yeah. And he probably saw this as another way out. And, he may have even foreseen how much reaction this would get and publicity it would bring to the thing. We don't know. But, that's the position he was put in by those prosecutors. And people are put in that every day by prosecutors. It's just that he was one of us that we see this.
Yes, well said.
He's a martyr in the classic sense of the word. And I think his death will have meaning. I think there's no doubt about that.
But I don't want anyone to think that suicide is the way to get meaning
in
your life.
No, and that's really important.
It is so watching that video. Just that video alone, listing all his achievements and watching that video, what we have lost, what suicide robbed from first him and his family and his loved ones, but also from all of us. And suicide is, God damn it, is not the way out, not the answer. And
yes,
that's all.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, I do want to talk about the new Facebook search, because I don't know whether it's good, bad, and different. There is some Google news. We'll find it. Mr. Schmidt goes to Pyongyang.
There's a Google connection to that Facebook story, which we'll talk about.
Yes. In fact, this is probably what Google's long feared. Should it fear it? That's the question. All of that still to come. You're watching This Week in Google. Kevin Marks, I'm really glad you're here. Thank you for volunteering to come and talk. We appreciate it. From TumbleVision.tv, Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at City University of New York, and He blogs at buzzmachine.com. Of course, Gina Trapani from smarterware.org.
And thank you for devoting that time to Aaron.
You know, it's not the first. We did it on Twitter. We've done a number of shows. And
good.
I, you know,
I'm glad.
You know, I feel bad because on Triangulation right after this, we're interviewing Alex Ohanian, the founder of Reddit. Yeah. But he asked not to talk about Aaron. And I'm not sure for what reasons, but we won't be able to really spend a lot of time with him talking about that. It may be just too painful.
Yeah.
Alexis may not want to cry on the air. How do you go to a commercial now? I should play some happy music and take your mind off all of this. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. If you do any mailing at all, this is a great solution for you. You don't have to go down to the post office anymore. You don't have to buy a postage meter and stock it with overpriced ink, special ink. You use your regular ink on your printer and your computer with Stamps.com. It's a pro tip for anybody who does a lot of mailing. In your business, do you send out mailers, invoices, bills? Are you a seller online at Amazon, eBay, Etsy, PayPal? Do you use PayPal? You're going to love Stamps.com. If you use those sites, by the way, it will take the information for your buyer and put it on the mailing label, put your return address, and then print the right postage. Stamps.com is an amazing deal, too. Let me tell you, you get discounts you can't get at the post office, up to 21% on express mail, 15% on priority mail. It'll automatically email your recipient with a tracking number. It's just like professional shipping at your desk. You don't even have to get up to mail the package. No matter what size, the post office will come and get it for free. Stamps.com. Now, here's our special offer. You probably saw it on the front page there, $80 value and all that. No, we got better than that. Click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner at Stamps.com. Enter our offer code TWIG. There you go, T-W-I-G. And that $80 value turns into a $110 bonus value, including $55 in free postage. That beautiful aluminum digital scale, that's worth $50. You just pay shipping and handling, about $5. To make up for that, a $5 supply kit, and you still get the 4-week trial free of Stamps.com. Take advantage of this right now. Stamps.com, offer code's TWIG. Cancel at any time, that scale's yours to keep. Stamps.com. Back we go to This Week in Google. We talked a little bit about Eric Schmidt going to North Korea. Just strange. He says, hey, I was fighting for the open web. Don't think it's going to fall on receptive ears, to be honest with you. Governor Richardson, former governor of New Mexico, who went with Eric Schmidt to North Korea, says Schmidt was a rock star in North Korea. Interesting.
How do you not go? I mean, you know, you're Google. You can make a public appeal.
I'll tell you how you don't
appeal.
Go. The State Department said, please don't go. This generally happens when you're going to a country that is kind of the sworn enemy of yours. The people who are in the diplomatic corps would prefer that the amateurs stay home.
But Richardson's not an amateur.
Yes, he is. He's not anything. Well, he's a former UN ambassador, former governor of New Mexico. He's not representing the government.
No.
I think there's always a risk when well-meaning amateurs show up in these venues.
And the message was like, get on the internet or suffer later.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
It seems a little slightly threatening.
Richardson said that he believes effective foreign policy requires a mix of government, private citizens, philanthropic groups, and non-governmental organizations. I wouldn't disagree with that, but I just think there's a little risk. And we know Eric is a little bit of a loose cannon. it makes me nervous.
I think that any opportunity you have to put pressure on a recalcitrant, backwards, not open technology fearing company, country. I don't know.
Okay. I'm all for, look, where it's government of the people, by the people, for the people.
Yeah.
I mean, any citizen can go anywhere as long as it's understood he doesn't represent any official point of view.
If he had gone making all buddy-buddy, love ya.
Well, that's the risk. It's the Jane Fonda in a tank
being used.
photo op, right?
Right. But if you go and you say, I'm going to use this opportunity to pressure them to try to open up this connection to the world for these people.
Okay.
That's a message that I think is okay. You're right. It's a risk because you can be put in a photo opportunity. And the photo opportunities for Eric, of course, were hilarious. It was the mockery of the beloved
pink shirt
looking at things.
Well, it was also this sweater. Now, I just want to say, Eric, next time you go on a diplomatic mission, can you avoid the pink V-net sweater? I'm just saying. And I don't know Governor Richardson's. What is Bill Richardson wearing there?
Is that one of Vic Gondotra's?
He looks positively British.
They were never without their coats. It's obvious, it is a very cold
country.
They were never without their coats.
Governor Richardson talked to North Korea's vice minister for nuclear negotiations and said, you should temper your nuclear development efforts. And they pressed about who's being detained. You're right. I shouldn't be so negative.
No, I don't mean to. No,
Your points are fair, Leo.
Yeah, they are. I had the same struggle. Is this right or wrong?
Yeah.
I just ended up at a different spot. But no,
it's not like Richard Branson went there. I mean, it's at least somebody who's got some dignitas. It's not. I mean, it's Carrot Top going to North Korea to try to cheer him up. I mean, it's he's fighting for the open web and all of that. And meanwhile, the Google Earth put the North Korean gulag prison system on their maps. So,
that was convenient.
Yeah. That was a kind of like a little response. I don't know if he showed them. Have you seen this? all right. Moving on. Let's talk about.
Facebook?
We should talk about. We only have about half an hour more, so we might as well. Let's get this over with. Facebook
graph search.
First of all, bad name. No one in the real world has any idea what a social graph is. I only recently figured it out.
Exactly, I agree. But when I said that today, just as a branding thing, geeks went after me. Look it up. And I said, no. It's like branding point.
Yeah.
It's Zuckerberg's favorite word. He's always talking about the social graph.
What did Google call it? Search plus you or something, right?
Plus your world.
That makes sense to people.
This weird acronym is Spy World. Yes.
It's not very felicitous, but at least it's words people understand.
Why they just don't say social search or just
social
search.
No, I got the brand. Nosy search.
Nosy search.
So that's the okay. So there's different attitudes towards this. If you're a privacy advocate, Facebook is very clear saying, look, you're not going to be able to find anything you couldn't find otherwise. It's all the privacy controls you've already established continue to apply. Your friends will see what they can see. The public will see what they can see, but we're not going to breach that barrier. Nevertheless, I think because you can now search for stuff. Because people don't understand Facebook's privacy settings, there will be lots of inadvertent leaks of information. Certainly now's the time to start searching for that pictures of the ex-girlfriend.
Here's the thing I don't – because maybe it's just I don't use Facebook enough. I don't like – I mean, I don't, as a verb, like stuff, right?
I don't either.
I don't. And so I don't know how many of my friends do. Maybe it's just I'm an old fart. I don't know how valuable it's going to be. And it's still in that closed Facebook world where Google gives you, the whole world. And it uses – the other thing is you've got to do an explicit search for friends from Italy who've seen this movie, who have a cat in pictures before 1990. It's so Boolean about life. Whereas what Google tries to do is to just use this knowledge behind to feed relevance to you and to make some presumptive – decisions. Each one, somebody's going to call it creepy, but whatever. I just wonder how useful this thing's really going to be. We don't know yet, and maybe I'll be surprised, but...
It's only as useful as your friends use Facebook and you use Facebook. That's for sure.
Yes.
So just to zoom out, so graph search is the ability to search for people based on criteria. And now, let me just say that I have not used it yet. In fact, it hasn't been launched yet. You can sign up to be on the wait list at facebook.com/about/graph search. But it's basically advanced criteria. So just what Jeff said, you can say, show me all the TV shows that people, my friends who are software developers really like, or show me all the pictures of my friends in New York, or that kind of thing. So So likes, location, show me all the people, my friends list who work at Google, for instance. So it's just like advanced sort of search operators for people within Facebook.
I think it'll be great, the examples
they were giving were really off. Particularly in the Levy story, it's like single women near me, and
that's a good one.
Friends of friends who work at Google as programmers. And
yeah. Well, Anil, my business partner tweeted like, "What's the worst graph search criteria you can think of?" And someone said, "People who have just bought really expensive electronics and who are not home."
Oh, yikes!
In the wild thing is. People who like things that I like by Tom Stocky, and everyone who's in the list actually works at Facebook and is a dude.
Yeah, because I'll tell you why. So one of the examples they say this could be very useful recommendation engine if you're looking for a restaurant or a plumber or a dentist. But maybe it's just us. But let me ask the younger generation or whatever who uses Facebook. I don't even know. Chad, do you use? Are you?
I don't even use Facebook.
No, I don't know who uses. I think it's mostly moms.
The worst way to invite me to a party is to invite me on Facebook.
And so you would have to be that all your friends went through all of their dentists, plumbers, and liked them.
Who's going to say, "Boy, I just had a great tooth drilling. What a pleasure that tooth drilling was. I got to tell you about Dr. Schmidt with my tooth." Or my drain was clogged, but now it's clear. Who's going to present that as their life?
Right.
Nobody presents the practicality of life on Facebook.
Right.
What you present on Facebook is your view as if you were a star.
Right.
Right. Though, I mean, having just had those things done, I would share those with friends, but...
But you're not. You haven't already shared it, though, Kevin. So the problem is that to use it on a search,
the guys will ask you to do it, right?
The real problem is this is just going to step up.
Businesses are going to ask you to like them.
You got to like us. Yeah. You got to like us. It's just going to get horrible.
Leave us a review on Yelp. Right now, it's leave us a review on Yelp, and this will be us on Facebook, right?
It's good for Facebook's business because it's lock-in. You know, it means hey, you want to work on social graph search, even though you don't know what that means. You got to get somebody to like you.
Right. And it's, you know, the guy I go and get breakfast, coffees, and empanadas from, Big E in San Jose, great place, definitely go there. I've been going there for years, and I check in on Foursquare, and he was like chatting, he knew I was in tech, and he says, "Oh, what do I mean to do with all this stuff?" I said, "Well, there's lots of them, and you can try different ones out." And then last time I went, and he said, I found this thing called Hootsuite, and I can post to all these social media things at once." And this guy makes great coffee, and he makes great empanadas, and he feels like he has to do all this stuff now to promote his little coffee shop. So we're seeing that people want that. And obviously this is the thing that Facebook wants you to do. They want you to do those kinds of searches here because those are the searches they can monetize. The point of, the big difference between what Google has been selling and what Facebook is selling is Google has been selling intent. Most of the ads that Google sells are on, "I'm looking for X. I want a new TV screen. I need a plumber. I need, whatever."
And I don't think that's going to be useful. This is going to be useful for that.
And Facebook obviously wants that because what they've been selling is... we can sell you demographics. We can sell you people over 45 in San Jose who have a hot tub or whatever, assuming that you said you had a hot tub. And so they need that data to get richer, and they need you to actually mark more things off so that this stuff becomes useful.
Right. So what's going to happen, Kevin, is that the problem becomes the null search results that you're going to get out. So fine, you're going to go in. It's going to start up. You're going to try it. I have boring friends on Facebook. I'm not going to find anything. They limited their search universe to such a small amount of potential data. They are so highly dependent upon other users to do these things that we don't necessarily do. They're presuming that we do them unless they have more data about our behavior than I know, and I'm just weird, which is quite possible.
Isn't there a big risk for Facebook here that if people use it prematurely and it's not good, they're not going to come? Look at Kool and all these other Google wannabes.
What's premature, Leo? What they're arguing is that basically the database is already there. We have already spent years now telling Facebook all this stuff. All we have to do is unlock this data and get into it. If you start from data from today forward, they're really doomed. But I don't presume the data is there. Now, but John Battelle, who wrote a book, you know, the original search book about Google, was a smart guy, said that it changed his whole view of Facebook's prospects. I'm not getting this.
I mean, I got to tell you, I spent a lot. I'm a casual Facebook user, but I like pictures of my friends' kids and their pets and stuff. There's no way to see all the things that you've liked on Facebook. That makes me crazy. We've talked about this with Google Plus. It makes me crazy. I don't press the plus one button as a matter of principle because I'm just feeding their system, and I can't get that back. I can't say, show me all the stuff that I have plus one.
But this will let you do
friends.
That now.
But this will do that, right? Yeah. So at least I feel like at least Facebook is reflecting back the information that I'm feeding them. They're not just serving their advertisers. At least, you know, so Lars Rasmussen, who was the engineer at Facebook, who presented the graph search.
And
Lars is the same guy who built Google Maps with his brother down in Australia, and which was purchased by Google. And Lars was the guy who built Google Wave.
Okay. Google. You're a little biased.
This is the Google connection. I have a deep professional crush on Lars, I have to admit. He basically said that your favorite search in Facebook, the Facebook graph search, is going to be show me all the photos that I've liked. Right. And you can save these searches like pages. I mean, I got to tell you, my favorite view on Flickr are Flickr photos that I favorited over the years because they're all adorable pictures of my friends' kids and their pets and that kind of thing, stuff I want to remember, warm memories. My Twitter favorites, I also favorite stuff on Twitter. I love to be reminded of those. So I'm excited about graph search because I feel like I'm getting my data back and I get to see my friends' data in a more meaningful way, more meaningful than sponsored likes, you know, or ads.
And certainly that's one search that's useful. That makes Facebook no money. I can't think of any way to monetize your picture likes.
Show me all the songs that my friends have listened to in the past month on Spotify.
That you can monetize.
Make me a playlist of the top songs all my friends have listened to on Spotify in the last 8 months.
Now I'm liking that.
I mean, they've got so much data there. And I got to tell you, I have a great dentist. I love my dentist. She's amazing. I haven't liked her on Facebook, but she does this thing, and this is kind of ironic, but she sends cookies to anyone who refers a patient, right? Yeah. So if I like her on Facebook and one of my friends sees that I liked her and goes to her and says, like, I got referred to you by Gina, like, I get lots of cookies. So Dr. Miyashiro is in San Diego.
Sugar in them, and then
she gets more business.
There's xylitol cookies.
Well. I get cookies. She gets more business.
There's a gravel in there, so they break your teeth.
you're getting
Say her name again. I want you to get some cookies.
Dr. Ellen Miyashiro in San Diego.
There you go.
See her. She's great.
And make sure you mention Gina Trapani sent you.
Yes, please. Gina sent you. Gina sent you. Now I hope there'll be a stack of cookies when I get home.
That could be cool. That could be good. But that's what businesses are... Actually, that's a nice way to do it, but that's what businesses are going to certainly do if they don't have a page, they better damn well get one real quick. I mean, that's just prudent advice. If you don't have a Facebook page now, you better have one so people can like you.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So even if that's the only upshot of this, that's a good thing for Facebook.
Well, you know, Mike Elgin did a great piece on this in Datamation. He was talking about how basically if you love Facebook, you're going to love graph search. Right. And if you hate Facebook, then you will really hate graph search. But one of the things that he talked about was like the behavioral changes that we're going to start to see SEO for Facebook.
I saw that. Oh, my
people
God.
People just like everything because they want to show up in all the search results. People who would never have a Facebook page before are going to have a Facebook page now because the tool will affect behavior. So, you know, look. Facebook wants more people to participate in Facebook and more people to engage with especially with liking. But at the same time, you know, I hate the idea of an SEO community springing up. I mean, when Google's PageRank, you know, was kind of in its heyday, everybody was worried about how to optimize, you know, SEO their websites. And people are going to start thinking about this with their Facebook profiles.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you just gave me a horrible flash. So now Reputation.com is going to tell you to optimize your life.
He even used the phrase reputation management. Mike Elgin did in his article.
This is Goodhart's law, isn't it? Is that as soon as you measure anything, it becomes useless. And Google has done this to links on the web, and they've done it to words on the web now. And Facebook is about to do this to their own graph, and not really. Suddenly it's the thing that people are optimizing for, and then it gets damaged, and it's a problem. Yeah. So there's a couple of things about this that I do like. One thing I do like is the find people near X, because that's something. I need, because it's like, okay, I'm doing an event. I want to invite people who have a chance of getting to it. And that's impossible at the moment. I did this just before Christmas. I was trying to set up a microformats dinner in San Francisco on short notice. And I thought, right, I'll invite people in Facebook and G+. who are nearby, and we see who turns up. And on Facebook, I went through by hand. It was like, they're in, I think they're, and did that, and you know, few people saw it. And on Google Plus, I thought, oh, Google is smart about this. They'll only show this to people who are nearby. I use, you know, Google Now. It knows where I am. And so I just added my geeks group to it or something. And it got, you know, it looked like I was inviting them all to dinner. It looked like I invited 200 people to dinner, half of whom were in New York or, you know, the UK. And it wasn't, there wasn't any way of saying, no, actually, only make this a radius of 100 miles or so. So that piece is good. I like that idea. And that is directly useful. You know, the nearby thing, that's good. But I am worried that this is going to cause a whole bunch of sort of second order effects that people don't like. The other thing that strikes me about this is that the way likes are going, my youngest son, you know, I was sitting with him. He was on Facebook and I was doing something or other.
How old is he?
He's 16.
Okay.
And he was like, ah, it's the daily delete all your likes thing, because he's the
good for him. He has learned his lesson well.
No, because the ads pop up with things you like. Right. And he's like, yeah, I liked that 2 years ago. I don't want ads about it.
Right.
And he's like deleting all the old likes and getting rid of the ones because they're just spamming him now.
Yeah, that's tough for fickle people. Yeah,
I was just looking at my about page today, and stuff that I liked is like, oh, it's true. It's like, that's so 3 years ago. Yeah, you know, yeah. Like I, you know. But well, that's funny that like, she like actively maintains his likeless.
I once complimented my grandmother's carrot cake to her when I was 3 years old. So for the rest of my life, I loved nothing but carrot cake. And it's this treacly sweet stuff that I had to eat every time I saw
you
my grandmother.
You said you liked it.
Oh.
Just for you.
Yes. So Facebook becomes Grammy.
You know what they've done? I didn't know this, but now your likes have a timeline. Did you know that? You can see what you liked.
Yeah, split by year.
Yeah, you can like what you liked this year, last year, the year, going all the way back to what did I like in 2008? I'm wondering if there's anything there.
My problem is I'm grumbly. I didn't like anything.
Oh, you don't like enough stuff. I've deleted old likes because I don't see any likes going back that far. I still like Vi-Hart. I still like Roger Ebert. Still like Sonos. Gary Vaynerchuk. Yeah. Ford Focus. Like that.
Wow. Gary. Wow. Poor so, Gary. Yeah.
I like myself. Can you like yourself? Yes, you can. I like myself. So yeah, I mean you can.
But not Gary so much.
Yeah, I like my shirts. Apparently, somebody made a Leo Laporte shirts page. I didn't know that. I'm going to like that.
You're going to get Gary Vaynerchuk after you.
I know. Just watch. The Twitter tattletales are in force. Gary, did you hear what Leo said about you on Twig? No, you got, in fact, Scoble did this. He went through all of the brands that he liked and eliminated. So Scoble.
Right. It is a passing thing, though, right? Like, you can feel really passionate and happy about something when you've had a good experience, but then a couple of years pass, and you're like, oh, yeah. You know, just the memory is less.
It's potent. Very easy to like something.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, yeah, the reason I use Foursquare now is mainly to keep a history of where I've been and things. I mean, also that it feeds back, you know, gives me good recommendations. But I use it as an archive of, oh, yeah, I went to that place on that day, which is quite handy. I can see Facebook potentially being useful for that, but if it comes with ads and annoyances and noise in your stream, then I can see people deleting it again. It's somebody else told me about that they have this little thing they do, which is every day Facebook tells them people's birthdays, and if they go, I'm not sure I want to say happy birthday to them, they delete them as a friend because that's their way of getting rid of them. and if you do it on their birthday, they won't notice because
they got a lot of happy
their
stuff.
Their entire wall is full
That's
of stuff.
Clever. Birthday unfriending.
So it's this sort of rolling unfriending thing of like how to trim your graph without offending people.
Yeah, and after a year, you'll have gone through everyone.
Happy birthday. See ya.
Bye. Hope you have a good one.
You don't say happy birthday.
Nice knowing you.
Yeah, you don't say happy birthday.
They just disappear. Yep.
Yeah. And if you like them, you can buy them a cheesy gift. I like that. So Facebook stock price, did it go up after this big announcement?
I didn't
probably
long,
yeah, I saw Apple's went up a lot. I should ask Google now.
Facebook.
Google now will know. Let's see what Google now knows.
My Google Now doesn't know enough still. I'm still.
You still don't have a smart Google Now, huh?
I went through the whole McGill. I found one other new McGill. Somebody suggested to me that I had to go into my apps account and as an apps top administrator, say it was okay for my users, including myself, to have history in the browser. So I did all that. It's still not doing it for me.
Oh.
FB.
He's doing some, FB, but it won't even look at my weather
sometimes. Kind of flat, huh?
0.83%.
The market's Apple's not sure what it means. The market's trying to find out what a graph is.
Yeah.
It's funny because the API has been called the Graph API. So I just, I mean, I think as, and I work with the API for ThinkUp, and I just, I'm used to it. You know, it's just, it's a term like that I'm just kind of associate with Facebook, well, and I'm used to it. But but you're right. Like it makes no sense. I don't know why they just didn't call Facebook search or social search or people search.
This is the problem with being a nerd, is that you start getting, you know, well,
you
everybody
start
knows
used
what
to that. Stupid terminology.
Right.
Yeah. Like that term words that mean nothing. Yeah. Right. To the rest of the world.
Right.
I know I use the phrase data liberation all the time. And Neil always looks at me and is like, that's a Google. Like, people who don't cover Google don't know what that
right.
means.
Right.
I'm like, oh, right.
That at least those are English words that make sense.
So, yeah, you can gather contextual clues and figure out what that means.
But graph, I don't think graph gives you a lot of hints.
Well, I did the n-gram viewer on Social Graph. I just put a link in there. And it was this obscure technical term for most of the, basically for the 20th century, and then it suddenly goes zoop and shoots up by a factor of...
Look at that.
10 or so.
Wow.
Around 2005.
I'm surprised there was any noise about it before this. So it must have been some sort of sociology term.
It was a sociology term, definitely. And it was what you used to say this is how people are connected to each other. But it was you know, Dana Boyd, of course, has a great paper on this, the difference between the actual social graph and the publicly articulated social graph, which you do in Facebook or whatever. And so in sociology, they would model this and ask people who their friends were and get them to draw little bits of paper, and that was their way of doing it. And then with the rise of social networking, it was these things exploded and they became much bigger. And they're actually, you know, this is the I need to delete people on their birthdays problem. It's like, who are all these people who I've gradually friended over time, and now there's
here's by the way, this is so I see, this is why Google Books awesome. So we have to go back to 1910 and the Floyd Henry Alport and Gordon William Alport's personality traits, their classification and measurement, and you see
great.
In this figure the graph is because they divided personalities into a range of things, emotions and so forth. And then they drew a graph showing high and low, and they literally call this the social graph. This is one of the first Great. Appearances of the phrase social graph, the classification of personality traits.
Hmm.
This one's an introverted social type.
That's Zuckerberg's social graph.
Almost psychopathic. It says neurotic heredity.
I didn't say that.
Yeah, I think this isn't using in that tense term, is it? This is,
yeah, this it's not the definition. It does not mean what you think it does.
Anil says that Brad Fitzpatrick coined the term social graph in 2007 from Live Journal, and David Ricardo, in the first place.
Brad wrote a very good paper on it. That was a good essay that he wrote just like the day before he joined Google, while he could still speak in public. And he went on to build the social graph API at Google, which they killed this year. But that was crawling the web, looking for these links between friends and links between yourself, and making it available as a public API, which was a great service. And I hope, you know what kind of bugs me about
all of this is that Facebook spent millions of dollars lobbying Washington to change a law so that you could share your Netflix viewing habits on Facebook. And even though we're in the middle of this debt ceiling negotiation, there's a lot of important stuff on Congress's doorstep. The Video Privacy Protection Act did get updated, and last Thursday, President Obama signed that bill just in time to add your Netflix viewing habits to your social graph. Thank you, Facebook.
Digital pork.
Yeah, H.R. 6671, the Video Privacy Protection Amendments Act.
Well, I'm also glad it's there, and that was really the Justice Bork law before.
Yeah, it banned the sharing of any video history information. Not Bork, it was, wasn't it,
That was Bork. It was Bork.
Bork got in trouble for his video habits because so did the other guy who got in, and I'm conveniently blank. Clarence Thomas conveniently blanking out his video habits.
Clarence Thomas was Coke cans. Bork was videos.
That's right. Yeah, you're right.
Am I right?
I'm confusing Long Dong Silver with something else.
Right, and the pubic hair on the Coke can.
Yeah. Are you going to send Mark Zuckerberg pay $100 and send him a message? I like your social graph. Gary Vee has responded. It's just a joke, Gary. I love you, baby. I love you.
We love Gary. Wait, where did he respond?
I don't know.
Of course he responded. Gary, that's what Gary does. Yeah. He's the most responsive human on the internet.
That's why I love him.
He's always got his ears on.
He says, Leo Laporte, I'll always like you, but more importantly, always respect you. Happy New Year, Gary V.
he's classy, that dude.
Thank you,
just classy.
Twitter tattletales, once again. Oh, no, he's responding to talking about how he liked you in 2008 on Facebook. See, this is the problem, is it does it in 140 characters. There's no context.
No wine for you.
Yeah, really. Love you, Gary. Don't listen to them. So Facebook, remember they said for $1, we can make sure that your message gets in your friend's inbox, not the other folder. And then apparently some people are getting the message for $100. If you didn't friend Mark Zuckerberg, and he has quite a few friends, then you might get a message that says, you aren't connected to Mark on Facebook. Your message would normally get filtered to the other folder. Would you like to send it to him for $100? Send to inbox for $100.
So Facebook is monetizing email.
Yes. Well, you could say, if somebody's willing to spend $1, then they're probably not a spammer.
I mean, that's the issue with email, right? Like, to send somebody postal mail, you have to pay for postage. You have to get a stamp. It puts the onus on the sender, right? They have to pay, right? But the problem with email is it puts the onus on the recipient. It costs nothing, so that's why we get spam. So I've always felt like it should be a little harder to contact someone by email because that would counter spam. I just, something about this just doesn't feel right. I wish it wasn't Facebook.
Gina, the you're right. Logically, that's the way it works. But the contrary proof is that the USPS is now an entirely business of junk mail. And the only ones who pay to send mail anymore are junk mailers.
Right. That's really true.
So inevitably, what you're going to get down to is they're going to be some kind of open marketplace, and they're selling our supposed attention and our mailbox, and we have no control. It goes back to what Bob Wyman told me a long time ago, but the problem with email is when the sender controlled email, that's what ruined email. And Google Plus, the recipient controls. And that's the recipient key difference.
That's
recipient
better, isn't
controls.
It? Yeah, that's really the way
How so on Google Plus? By saying
because on,
you're
on
in
Google
my
Plus, you only receive messages from people you choose to receive messages from. The only things that didn't work because you used to get notifications, and that got spammed immediately, so they had to kill that. But now you can decide who can communicate with you.
You should be able to do that in comments, too.
Yes,
right. So, like on Twitter. So on Twitter, someone can direct only people who you follow can direct
DM
message you.
Yeah.
That is what Facebook built in the first place. The reason people started using Facebook instead of email
was because
you choose who could send you stuff. Right? If they're not friends, they can't message you.
Well, they can though now if they are willing to pay
$1.
It goes
in that other folder that you never see.
Right.
If you go to Facebook, there's a look in messages and click like three times or something. There's an other folder that has messages from people who've sent you thing to that fake email address that Facebook created for you and then synced into everybody's address book.
Right? We're running up against the clock. We got to run. So let's get our tips, number, and tool of the week in just a second. But first, a word from our sponsor, our new sponsor, LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom's not a law firm. What LegalZoom does is it helps you get your legal work done. You know, there's a lot of stuff you can do yourself. Incorporate your business, form an LLC. That's what we did. Starts at $99 at LegalZoom.com. It's a great idea. If you're a blogger, you can protect trademarks, copyrights. You can even do patents and NDAs and more, all at LegalZoom.com for much less than it would cost you to go to a what do they call them? White shoe law firm. If you got a family, you got to get a will. Protect your family and your assets. Just $69 for a legal Zoom will. You could establish a living trust there, too. And, you know, it's really simple. You just walk through a questionnaire. They ask you, this is, you know, this the way the same way that online services and software transform the way you do taxes, LegalZoom is transforming the way people do simple legal tasks. Over the last 12 years, 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom for LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks. It's easy to use. They've got great customer support. They've also got a new service, which I really like. If you do need legal advice, they have an extensive network of attorneys with pre-negotiated prices in most states. So you can also talk to an attorney if it gets to the point where you go, you know, I really would like some advice on this particular point. Start your business. Protect your family today. LegalZoom.com. They're not a law firm. You can get self-help services at your specific direction or even speak to a legal plan attorney and get your questions answered and get ongoing advice at a fraction of the cost of a fancy law firm. To receive a special thank you for using LegalZoom through TWIT, we want you to mention you heard it on TWIT. We're going to give you an extra $10 off at checkout. Just make sure you use our offer code, TWIG. The offer code is TWIG. At LegalZoom.com, and as a thank you, $10 just for using it. I think you're going to like it. LegalZoom.com. Time for Gina Trapani's tip of the week. Tip tool. It could be a tool. It could be a tip. It could be anything.
By episode 500, you're going to get that.
Oh, right. I don't. I only started pronouncing your name correctly in the last few months.
Both pronunciations are okay.
Okay. All right.
All right. Tip this week is Yahoo Image Search has restored the ability to get images which are Creative Commons licensed. That means that they're reusable. Yahoo Search had this for a while, but then they took it away when Bing Search replaced it. They have since restored it. So if you go to Yahoo Image Search, you click on the bar on the side, and this works on both mobile and in the browser. You can search for images. And then you can say, just show me ones that are available for reuse. This is a huge, huge help to anyone who publishes online, who makes presentations, who only wants to use photos which are Creative Commons licensed that can be used. So I'm really happy that it's back. I'm feeling very, very good about Yahoo. I'm feeling good about Flickr. And most of these images, obviously, that are CC licensed are from Flickr. So if you're missing that image search, it's back, and you can post beautiful blog posts about sunsets with Creative Commons license, freely reusable images right from your phone or in your browser now using Yahoo Image Search. I think I'm going to change my image search shortcut in Chrome to Yahoo Image Search now. Wow. That this is back. Yeah.
It never went away on Flickr, right?
It didn't ever go away in Flickr, right? So this is integrated into the Yahoo experience. It was, right, and then Bing kind of took it away, but it was always on Flickr, and that was something that the Flickr search is great too.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, Bing might be the big benefactor of this new social graph search because it's going to be incorporated into Bing search as well.
Mm-hmm. So that, also, they get all the ones that Facebook can't fulfill. So.
Yes. Interesting. Kevin, would you like to throw anything in? I don't want to leave you out in the cold. Is there anything you're using on with Google or anything you want us to highlight?
I would say watch that whole talk from Aaron.
That's, do. Yes.
That would be my... spend 20 minutes watching that this week.
Yep, I agree. I agree with you 100%.
Yep.
Your number of the week, Mr. Jarvis. Oh, he's muted. You're muted. Jeff, you're muted. No? You're baffled. Jeff, you're baffled. And you're muted. Hello, Jeff. Is it us?
Aw.
I like Jeff's like, I don't know.
It's not us. I'm looking at our board. Everything looks fine.
Well, it is 6 o'clock Eastern time. I think you're hard out. When you said hard out, I think they meant we're going to cut your microphone. This is like the Golden Globe Awards.
I would triple check that maybe the button on Skype didn't accidentally get pressed.
Did you watch the Golden Globes, Gina?
I didn't. Were they good? Were they worth watching? Well, I heard about my girl Jodie Foster.
Yeah.
Of course.
I was going to ask you. I couldn't tell if she came out or not.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I mean, it's sort of been an open secret.
She mentioned her longtime partner. So that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think pretty much everyone knew, but just didn't really. It was kind of like Anderson Cooper, you know?
Right.
Kind of an open secret kind of thing.
And then she acted as if I'm never going to work in Hollywood again, which is like, Jody, I think you will.
Yeah, I think she
You know what, Jody? I think it's going to be okay.
It's
a shame that there really is still a stigma, and there are many Hollywood stars who just will not say anything about it.
I think it's also partly age, right?
That
she's generation from a time where it was more difficult.
Yes.
There's some pretty well-known leading men who...
Oh, yes. Oh,
yeah,
of course.
You're right. Well, especially that she was a child star, you know, that she had experienced fame very early, you know, in a different generation. I think that she just became protective of her life because she was in the spotlight.
That's what I loved.
Early age.
I loved her saying, you know, there's this thing about privacy. I know, Jeff, you might disagree, but... I did like it that she said...
No, I get that. She's got to protect that.
Yeah.
And by the way, I still have a crush on her.
Oh, yeah. Who doesn't?
Oh, yeah. She's completely crush-worthy. All genders welcome.
Amazing.
But she's also had some horrific stalkers as well.
Well, that's true, too. John Hinckley, of course. And that's a very good point. Yeah, she had good reason to want to be private.
Yeah.
All right. I've stalled long enough. Jeff's microphone came back.
I screwed up. I didn't know that I bonged my little thing here.
Oh, you know, anytime I use a bong, that happens to me, too.
I know.
I bonged my little thing.
All right.
That also the technical term.
Sound engineers use it all the time.
Don't you, Gina?
Your number, sir.
Well, all right. I was going to do I'm going to do this one. One donkey is still alive in the world. If you go into the rundown and look at the Business Insider link there, Leo, Google was accused of killing a donkey on Street View, but the accusers got the video the order wrong, and in fact the donkey lives. I think it's an important thing. Donkeys were killed in this Street View.
How could Street View kill a donkey?
The truck. And the problem was whoever did it looked at Deadspin or somebody looked at the stills in reverse and thought the donkey was dead in the road. In fact,
it was the other way around.
And the truck came along and woke up the donkey, and the donkey moved off.
The Google Street View woke up a donkey.
And Business Insider showed the proper order to the photos. So this big controversy. Google had to defend themselves that Street View didn't kill a donkey.
So they did knock a deer down a few years ago, right?
Somebody has way too much time.
Jeez, Kevin.
How many images are there on Street View that you would have to comb through?
I know.
But this is the point. You know, the Google can't do this. This is can you look at all the images uploaded to YouTube? But if you go down your own street and there's a deer lying in the street, what the hell? You post that to there. And so there are all these spotted on Street View things that are where did that go? So yeah, why was somebody browsing?
He doesn't look. He doesn't look like a well donkey.
He was rubbing his back.
He was rolling in the dust.
And then there he is.
There he is. He's got under the car.
The donkey lived, ladies and gentlemen.
But they did actually hit a deer. In 2000, I just put the link to the Guardian thing of that. I think they actually took the images out, but there was this like deer lying in the road, and then you see it getting up again afterwards.
Oh, well, he's not dead. He's just pining.
In my neck of the woods, they're tall rats.
He's pining for the fjords.
But there's a whole blog devoted to weird stuff you found in Street View.
I know, like, I love it.
The guy asleep on his own lawn, and the house that burns down as they drive past the street.
Crazy stuff. I'm going to suggest that people listen to All About Android last night because you covered about 8 different great calendar apps, and I can't decide which one. I did download and install Agenda because I love that from way back when it was an iOS app. It's just the cleanest, simplest calendar app.
And if you swipe from left to right, it goes from it goes from the year. Now swipe again. Yeah, so that's
awesome.
the year view. And then it goes more
from
then month
Google?
And then week
Isn't
and day.
Great?
Yeah, it syncs to Google. It can do multiple Google accounts, multiple calendars. And then if you swipe again, it'll go event specific. It's just really nice. It's just and it's very simple.
Here's a quick question. Gina, can I stop it from changing the darned time zones? So when I put in, so I'm going to Davos next week, where you'll see me next week, right? So I put in something that's going to occur at 7 at night. It thinks that it's UTC time, and so when I get there, it changes it by 5 hours. Google does.
Can't you tell Google Calendar not to do that?
I can't find. No, I.
That's a setting in Google Calendar.
When you enter, so this is what I do is when I enter the event, I specify the time zone. So I set, you know, so I would say for Twig, I would say, and I'm in New York.
That's the best way to do it.
I would say Twig 4 p.m. EST, and then it adjusts for Pacific. And then when I come to New York, it adjusts, you know what I mean? So if you specify the time zone on entry, then you'll be set.
Thanks.
I think it happens when you import a calendar from somewhere else because the calendar file format, if you don't specify a time zone, defaults to local. Which was a rational decision at the time.
Yeah.
But that means if you've got an imported calendar that's coming from an arbitrary place and it doesn't specify a time zone, that's what you get. So it's a bug in the IGAR form, basically.
And just
what I really wish is that I wish I could say on these dates I'm going to be in this time zone.
Yeah.
So show me everything there.
And just listen to the time that I got. All right, thank you. That was my
for people who travel, it's a big thing. Steve, you know, just so you know, Steve Martin was really upset about this. And and begged me for a way to just say, I just want everything in my local time. I can tell the difference.
Exactly. That's all I want.
Yeah.
Give me that as an option, Google.
I'll do the subtraction. And you know what? They listened to him on iOS because he was talking about the iPhone, and you can do that in iOS. That's why I thought you might be able to do it on Google Calendar. You can't, but you can do it in iOS.
So what I do is when I travel, I don't change the clock on my laptop, but I just let the phone change itself. So I've got both.
That's another way to do it, sure.
Mm. If you're carrying both. And that means, that has blown me up before because I was in New York and I was thinking, I've got plenty of time. And it's like, oh, wait, I'm looking at the computer, not the phone.
I missed a huge meeting in California
because of this.
Yeah, because I was 6 hours off because I had adjusted and then it adjusted itself and I was off. I totally missed a meeting. It's amazing that. And I know that you have to enter it by the local time. So I don't know.
There's one that the one that I like in the Google thing is which is explicitly for flights is you can set the start and end time to be different time zones, which is very handy when you're transferring your flights in. So you can say I'm taking off at this time in this time zone and I'm landing at this time in this time zone.
Oh, that's nice.
Well, next week you're going to see me from Swiss time zone. I will be in Davos.
The ever loving Davos.
Did I say hi, JP?
Yes, I will.
So, by the way, it is a feature in the Google version of the calendar. Thanks to the Jay Moon in our chat room for pointing this out. Use home time zone.
Where?
It's only on the phone. It's in the that new calendar app that you can download, the Google Canonical Calendar app, so you don't have to use the Samsung app. Home time zone displays calendars and event times in your home time zone when traveling.
Thing. Your home time zone when traveling.
And you could specify your home time zone, which for some reason is Seoul, Korea.
Oh, yeah.
I should fix that probably.
It thinks my home time zone is GMT,
Well, no, it's defaulting to where this phone was made, I guess. Anyway, we're a little late. You guys got to go. I know. Jeff Jarvis, thank you so much for being here from Rhode Island. Thanks to Bryant College for letting you use their facilities.
Thank you, Bryant College. Wonderful place.
Good luck in Davos.
Thank you. I'll see you next week from the snowy mountains.
That was fun. We've done this every year now for the last few years, and it's always interesting. Yeah. Thank you. Maybe you can get Bono to come over and say hi.
I was going to say, get us a star. Get us
Bono. Not Scoble. Yeah. Bono.
Get us an A-lister. Come say
Scoble's
hi on Twig.
Scoble's not going. Wow.
That's what I heard.
Wow. Shocking.
Yeah.
Kevin Marks, thank you for being here. Tumblevision.tv. Still in hiatus on Tumblevision?
Still on hiatus, but we're still trying to get that back together. Hopefully it's almost a year since we stopped. So, we want to get that back up again.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate your insights.
Thanks for letting me in.
And, of course, Gina Trapani, smarterware.org, thinkup.com, and todo.text.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks to 20x200 for hosting me tonight.
What a nice office.
In New York.
She's checking in. Lots of art on the walls. All right, guys. Thanks for joining us. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern time. That's 2100 UTC on twit.tv. If you don't get to watch the live show, and do watch live if you can, because I like that, because then I can interact with you and all that. We do make on-demand versions available, audio and video, always after the fact, either at our website, twit.tv/twig, or online, or on our new Google YouTube channel, which is, what is our YouTube channel? YouTube.com/twig. YouTube.com/twig. So what we've done is each show now has its own YouTube channel. And going forward, we don't have the old shows here, but going forward, you could subscribe to the YouTube channel and you'll get a notification every time a new video comes out and you can watch on YouTube as well. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. There it is. Look at that. Jeff and Gina.
Wow, look at that art.
Don't you like that? It's cool. Art. We got art.
I need a shave.
Gina just looks sad.
No, do I look sad?
She's kind of mournful.
Wistful.
The wistful Gina Trapani. And I'm in the middle. It's a shame. But I am there on the cloud there. You just can't. Yeah. Sometimes that just, you know, being in the middle doesn't work out. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on Twink.